to Catherine Fox. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Can you hear me over the background music? Is this loud enough like this? I could wrap the whole thing if you like. Oh, stop now. Well, this afternoon I'm going to try and let you in on some of the tricks of the trade of being a novelist. And I thought it best to jump on the celebrity chef bandwagon and tell you how to be a naked domestic fiction writing goddess or god. The novel, basic recipe. Ingredients. One major theme, one central character or group of characters, one plot plus a handful of subplots if liked, settings. Use the most authentic available. Assemble ingredients gradually over weeks and months. Brew slowly in the imagination. Use the biggest you have. Experiment with adding dialogue, characters, humour, and imagery. Continue cooking until done. Be patient. This may take years with a big novel. When ready, allow your agent or editor to taste. They may recommend further cooking and the addition of more spice. Finally, serve up to the public in sophisticated hardback covers embellished with puffs, rave reviews, and striking author photo. If hardback is not readily available, paperback makes an acceptable alternative. Sit back and wait for reviews, if there are any. Commit the bad ones to memory and overlook all the rest. Look hard at the finished novel and analyse its shortcomings, then put it all behind you and start all over again. And here are some chef's hints. Once you've got the hang of it, this basic recipe can be adapted to make many different kinds of novel. A light fairy cake kind of novel that you can consume in one sitting, a vast Rococo five-tier wedding cake of a book, a homely traditional fruit loaf story, a pan forte style novel, slim, dark, densely written, rich, to be savoured gradually. But whatever style you adopt, it should always be Moorish. After the first bite, your reader should be hooked. But where can you get hold of the ingredients that you need? Don't you all just love Nigella? Lark's tongue pate can be bought in all good delicatessens. If you're having difficulty getting hold of it, why not move to a nicer area? One of the questions that writers get asked most frequently is, where do you get your ideas from? And there's a brilliant answer that I'm always tempted to give in a novel by Robert B. Parker. He's a detective fiction writer. One of the characters says, where do I get my ideas from? From my head. I think them up. All the ingredients come from the author's imagination, or else they have to be sieved or filtered through the imagination. And these might be observations, overhearings, things you've read, other people's ideas, that's not necessarily plagiarism, personal experiences. The crucial bit is the sieving or filtering. I can remember one occasion, years ago now, when I was on a writing course, and I was asked to provide a piece called Seen Through a Window. I duly handed in my description of an experience I'd had looking through a window at the cloisters at Durham Cathedral. But when the teacher gave it back, she said, "This is totally unconvincing." "But it really happened," I protested. And I think this is quite an important lesson. You can't just take chunks of undigested experience and lob them into the narrative and expect them to work. The temptation is to think that you know what you're talking about, and then you forget that the reader hasn't seen what you see. The classic example of this is to get halfway through your book without bothering to tell the reader what your protagonists look like. I think this is because they're so vivid in your mind that you forget that the reader has no idea. There's a similar problem with dialogue. Ordinary human conversation makes lousy dialogue in a work of fiction. It's full of inanities and interruptions and half sentences. Good dialogue is carefully crafted and honed until it sounds convincing. But I'll tell you more about dialogue later. I'm going to spend the next few minutes doing a kind of culinary analysis of some of my work, just to give you some idea of how they came into being. Of course, this rather twee domestic analogy might not work for you. I used it once when I was leading a seminar with another author. His response was to say that the process of writing fiction was nothing like that. He saw himself as a kind of a caveman hunter figure, going out to slay a wild beast. When the book was finished, he saw himself placing a foot triumphantly on its carcass and raising a fist in victory. Well, whatever works for you, really. My first novel was called Angels and Men, and like most first novels, it was a long time in the writing, or the baking, if you prefer, or the hunting. And the first seed of an idea, to change abruptly into horticultural imagery for a moment, was of two twin sisters who were involved in an extreme charismatic sect. One of them broke away from the sect, but the other didn't. This idea came to me in 1986 when I was reading endless 17th century Quaker pamphlets in Woodbrook College Library in Selly Oak. I suppose my mind must have wandered. The main theme of the book is of religious fanaticism, and this was driven by my personal experience of the charismatic revivals in the 70s and early 80s, but also informed by my research into early Quakerism. My experience of academic research wasn't actually a particularly happy one, and finishing the thesis was a real long slog. I knew by 1986 that what I really wanted to do was write novels. But I also knew myself well enough to realise that if I started writing my novel at that point, I would simply abandon the PhD. So I promised myself I wouldn't start writing the novel until the thesis was done. With hindsight, this was no bad thing for the novel either. It meant that I lived with the central character, Mara Johns, with her in my mind for 4 years before starting writing the novel proper in 1990. And just to give you an idea of time scale, the book was published finally in January of 1997, so that's 11 years after I got the first idea. So if there are any budding writers out there, be patient. So that's the central theme and the main character, but what about the other ingredients? What about the plot? I generally have some difficulty describing the plots of my books, and I think this is probably because the books are driven along by the characters rather than having a framework of action into which the characters must fit. Quite often when I'm talking to people who want to write a novel, they tell me that they don't think they've got enough material. They can write a chapter or two, but then they run out of ideas. Well, one possible answer here is that they are naturally short storytellers and not novelists. I think all writers tend to have a natural word length, and mine seems to be about 120,000 to 150,000 words. That's 300 to 500 pages. And I find that editors generally seem to think it should be a little shorter than this. I do find it quite difficult to advise people who feel they've got no plot. Until my last book, I believed that I did write to a preconceived plan, albeit a rather loose one. But when I wrote my fourth book, which I've just finished, I didn't really have any clear idea of what was going to happen. When I stopped to think about it, that's probably what I did with the previous three books as well. I just thought I knew what was going to happen. There are always several stark instances of the plot taking an unpredictable turn. In Angels and Men, my first book, when I wanted to create a character, I wanted to create a character who would kind of fight at the same weight as the heroine, someone who would be as nasty as her, if not nastier, so that she would appear in a slightly more sympathetic light. Hence the character of Andrew Jacks. He was only supposed to be a walk-on part, but the character grew and developed until I began to suspect, there might be a love interest here. So I kept sort of doing the literary equivalent of dimming the lights, but nothing ever happened. Eventually, when I was about halfway through the book, it occurred to me to ask myself, is this man gay? And instantly, this made sense of everything that was going on. And my heart sank rather at the thought of all the rewriting I was going to have to do. But when I came to look, there was actually only half a sentence that had to be cut. So my subconscious had known all along. I suppose this is one of the things I would say to someone trying to write a novel and thinking that they'll run out of material. Trust to your subconscious. It knows more than you do. Creative writing is a partnership, I believe, between what comes up from the subconscious mind and the crafting and editing work that's done by your conscious mind. Sitting down and trying to invent a plot out of your own cleverness could be a recipe for writer's block, to return to our culinary theme. The other thing that I'd say, and this is being the kind of writer that I am, and other writers will probably tell you something different, I would advise you to get to know your central character or characters. Spend hours in their heads trying to think and feel as they do. It's a bit like method acting, I guess. I can remember seeing a documentary once, Dustin Hoffman rehearsing a stage version of The Merchant of Venice, and he kept agonising over the various characters' motivations. And then he just walks off. He walks off without saying anything. Why doesn't he say anything? And you could see all the English actors looking at one another. "Because he's got no lines," came the answer. Ideally, I aim to get to the stage where I could tell you what drink my different characters would order if they were walking into a pub, or whether they wouldn't walk into a pub at all. To help you with this kind of thing, you could compose a kind of character questionnaire. Age, sex, family background, beliefs, looks, education, secrets, fears, hopes, and so on. But let's return to our recipe for writer's block. I think it goes something like this. Clear your diary, tell everyone you're going to be a writer, sit down at your word processor, a plain notebook and pencil may be used if preferred, write novel. Result: blank page or screen and total loss of self-esteem. Writer's block is what writers fear most. Well, apart from the spectacular success of other younger writers. There are ways around it, though. Richard Beard, who was that Neanderthal novelist I referred to earlier, deliberately sets himself certain constraints in which he has to write his novels. In his second novel, for instance, which is called Damascus, all but 12 of the nouns can be found also in a copy of the Times from November the 1st, 1993. You don't actually find that out until the very end. It's just a little note at the back of the book. And all the way through, you're thinking, why are these recurring images? It's a brilliant book. I would recommend it. Damascus by Richard Beard. And I've heard him say that he finds the idea of embarking on a novel without some kind of boundary or constraint really daunting. Rather than shackling the imagination, the constraints create liberty. How does this work, you might be wondering? Suppose we tweaked our recipe so that it went something like this. Sit down at your word processor and write a novel, which must include a pair of gardening gloves, a tower block in Wolverhampton, a large gathering of people dressed as Ned Flanders, and the phrase, "Tonight we drink man blood." Well, immediately, the imagination has got something to work with. And here's another question that I'm always being asked. Do you write longhand or do you use a word processor? My answer always used to be that I wrote longhand and then transferred it onto the computer later. And there is a lot to be said for this. If you fall on hard times, you can always flog your manuscripts to an American university. And you do hear tales of authors painstakingly transcribing their novels up into notebooks later for that very reason. The other advantage of working with pen and paper is that you can keep the various drafts and see all the layers of text and editing. However, about halfway through my fourth book, I switched to working straight onto the screen. The most striking impact this had was to double my output. It felt also more direct, somehow, as if I were cutting out the middleman. And I had a much more vivid sense of not knowing what I was going to write until I saw it, which is actually very exciting. And I think that means you're kind of closer, in closer contact with your subconscious. This isn't to say that I had no idea at all about what was going to happen. I think I knew roughly what was going to happen, but not exactly where in the narrative, and whether all the things I had in mind would end up being used. I also had one character that I simply couldn't make my mind up about. Was he genuine or was he a complete fraud? It wasn't until the closing chapters that it became clear to me. I'd have to say that writing like this takes a bit of nerve. There's always the fear that the whole thing will fold, or that you'll end up writing yourself into a corner of some kind. Looking back, I think this book has actually been freer from technical problems than the previous books I've written. And maybe you are less likely to go down a cul-de-sac if you haven't got a clear plan than if you have. I'm not really sure. I also don't know whether this method only works if you're halfway through a book, or whether I could write the whole book without a plan. I'll wait and see for my next book. I said I'd return to dialogue. Now, for me, this is one of the thrills of reading and writing fiction. Somebody once told me about a novel they were planning to write in which there would be no dialogue at all. This was a deliberate stylistic device intended to convey the isolation of the central character. This may well work, you can only try it and see. But I'd have to confess that my instinctive response was that it wouldn't be the kind of book I would be attracted to. A couple of months ago, I was teaching a creative writing course and had to stop and analyse what function I thought that dialogue served in a piece of narrative. And here's what I came up with, some of it anyway. Dialogue reveals character, it conveys information, it dramatises the action, by which I mean it's a way of showing the reader what happened rather than simply telling them and summarising it. It varies the pace, and it creates visual variety on the page. This last point may not seem terribly important, but I don't think it should be overlooked. For instance, if you're flipping through a book idly to see if you want to read it, the sight of long paragraphs spanning entire pages may well put you off. Your eye will tend to skim over those passages to look for a spot of action. Dialogue is always a good bet. This is where you get two or more characters interacting. This is where the sparks will fly. Dialogue might be about communicating, or it might be about the failure to communicate, and I really love it. And that's why I hurry towards it in anticipation when I'm reading. I can see it coming on the page. But the two most important functions of dialogue, in my view, are that it reveals character and that it conveys information. Let's look at them in that order. Dialogue reveals character. Thy speech betrayeth thee, as the King James Version of the Bible puts it about St. Peter. It's not just what you say, but the way that you say it, which reveals the truth about you, and also what you don't say. As I said earlier, writers need to know their characters inside out. The same applies for the way the characters speak. You need to be able to hear their voices in your head. And here's a nice quote from Margaret Chittenden writing in the Sunday Times. Many people hear voices when no one is there. Some of them are called mad and are shut up in rooms where they stare at the walls all day. Others are called writers and they do pretty much the same thing. I met someone recently who directs plays, and he said that one of the tests for a good script is to cover over the left-hand column where the characters' names appear, read the play, and see if you can still tell who's speaking. The same applies for novels. If you take out all the she saids and he saids, can you still work out who's talking? Ideally, I think you can. The type of person your character is will determine how he or she speaks, obviously. The content and the vocabulary, the turns of phrase, the amount they speak, whether they're garrulous or taciturn, and the accent. Now, accent can be a tricky one. The reader needs to feel safe in your hands, because nothing is more off-putting than reading a book where the accents aren't quite right. And there are tricks to the trade here as well, of course. You can simply tell the reader that your character speaks with an accent. He replied in his soft Irish brogue. Or you can throw in a couple of well-known bits of dialect as markers, and then basically leave the reader to do the work. At the other end of the spectrum, you can you sometimes come across entire novels written phonetically in dialect. And it has to be said, these can be a bit hard going for the non-native speaker. But basically, the better you know the accent, the more convincingly you'll be able to render it in your fiction. Over the course of my first three novels, because I was at that time living on Tyneside, my grasp of Geordie got better, and the result was that the characters' accents got more marked as the books went on. I don't suppose I could do that now. Instead, I'm trying to get my head around the Black Country accent. But I think you need to spend as much time as you can soaking up the accent. And if you can't actually get to the live and stay in the area that you're wanting to use, then soap operas and TV are very good for helping with that. The other vital function of dialogue is to convey information. But let the writer beware. It's all too easy to set up a fictional conversation to fill the reader in on important background and end up having the characters telling one another things that they already know. When I'm teaching creative writing courses, I rather meanly distribute handouts of bad examples of this from published novels. But I'm not going to do that today. Instead, out of a spirit of repentance, I'm going to offer you an example from my own work. The problem I hit was that I had two characters who were discussing something full of technical jargon, in this instance church jargon, which they both understood, but that the average reader wouldn't. This is from Love for the Lost. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Yes, thanks." He hesitated. "I better tell you. It's bound to crop up while we're away." "What is?" she said in alarm. "Bad news, I'm afraid. St. Mark's PCC met last night and they've just passed resolutions A, B and C." "What? But they can't." Well, I was going to leave it at that, but my copy editor insisted that no one would have a clue what they were talking about. Sometimes this is okay. Readers are prepared to take things on trust. But in this instance, it was actually fairly important to let everyone know why the heroine was so upset by these mysterious resolutions. So in the end, I had the other character saying, "Well, they're required by canon law to debate the issue of women priests and flying bishops the first time there's an interregnum." "I knew you'd laugh, you rotten lot." To which the heroine justifiably replies, "I know that." As you can tell, I'm still not happy with that. And the only thing I could have done, but slightly tricky at the copy editing stage, would be to feed the information in earlier, so that when this comes up, everyone thinks, "Oh yes, that's about women priests, isn't it?" But not so early that they'd all forgotten. And I'm really not in the business of having footnotes in novels. I know some novelists do. And if you want some really and truly ingenious examples of using dialogue to impart vast chunks of background, you need look no further than Harry Potter. There's nothing like an invisibility cloak to enable you to overhear people discussing vital pieces of information. Then there's the Pensieve, for those of you who've read, I think, is it book four, that one? Where Harry gets to see all Dumbledore's musings. Or there's Riddle's Diary, in which Harry gets to see the past. I'm not knocking this, by the way. I think it works brilliantly in the books. But sadly, we muggle writers don't have this kind of useful weapon in our technical arsenal. We want to fill the reader in on a character's background, of course we do. But we want to do it subtly and convincingly. And above all, we want to do it in a way that makes the reader eager to keep on turning the pages. To show you what I mean, here's an example, again from Love for the Lost. And I could have decided to tell you and summarise the contents of this scene that I will read shortly. And if I had chosen to do that, it would have gone something like this. Isabel and Jan were shocked to discover that Andrew's partner had died. After the meal, he told them something of how it had happened and went on to explore with them the possibility that he had a religious vocation. That's telling, and it's pretty flat and boring. But to give you a feeling for the characters, you need to dramatise it. And this will also reveal those facts that I've just summarised, but sort of piecemeal. And it's much more realistic, I hope. I'll just read you that bit. Isabel looked out of the window. It was getting dark. Sheet lightning was licking and flickering across the sky, eerie in the silence. "So, what are you doing with yourself these days?" Jan asked Andrew. "Je m'amuse," he replied, "in my donnish way." He stretched. "I might run away and join a monastery. You never know." "I don't think they take people on the rebound," said Isabel. Jan looked scandalised. Instantly, Isabel was ashamed. "Sorry," she said. "That was an awful..." "No, no," he cut in. "Bitch boldly or not at all." A painful silence fell. "How did someone as nice as Raphael put up with you for so long?" asked Jan in the end. "Because he was so nice, of course," he replied. "We represented a kind of slimline two-point Calvinism, irresistible grace and total depravity." There was a sudden explosion of thunder and they all jumped. Derek the cat yowled and fled. The window panes all rattled. A moment later, the lights went out. "Jesus, that was close," said Andrew. "I feel like a lightning conductor for the wrath of God." Jan laughed. "Why, what have you done now?" "Impersonated a priest." They stared at him in the gloom. His face was lit fleetingly by another flash of lightning. Jan got up to find some matches. "Another tarts and vicars party?" she asked. "No, I gave the last rites to a dying man, actually." A frisson of horror went through Isabel. Jan's hand paused with the lit match. "Raphael?" "Yes." She lit the candle and set it down on the table beside him. His beautiful features were illuminated like a painting by Delatour. They waited. After a while, he began. "At the end, he didn't know who I was anymore." He waved away their murmurs of pity. "He thought I was the priest and wanted absolution. Just one of those benighted Irish things." This aside was aimed at Isabel. "It was too late to fetch someone. He was dying in front of me. What was I supposed to do?" They waited, uncertain whether this was rhetorical. "Well," he prompted, "Isabel, you're the professional." He was mocking her, but she was obliged to treat his inquiry seriously. "Well, under those circumstances, you don't have to be a priest to pray a prayer of blessing," she asserted, "in the same way that midwives can baptize infants who are ready to die. The important thing is," he interrupted, "so you don't hold an ontological view of the priesthood." "I believe in the priesthood of all believers," she hedged, ontology being momentarily elusive. "But I'm not a believer." Isabel reminded herself that this was a bereaved man and said gently, "If you don't believe and you were just acting out of compassion, I can't see what's worrying you." "Nothing's worrying me," he said. "I'm just fascinated. Assuming, for the sake of argument, God exists, can a prayer by a hardened atheist invoke his blessing on a dying man?" "It's God who blesses," replied Isabel tartly. "You're nothing. The individual's nothing," she amended. "Do you say that kind of thing from the pulpit?" he inquired. "You're nothing. It has a certain Book of Common Prayer vigour to it. But pastorally, it's rather unfortunate." In desperation, Isabel prayed. She felt an abrupt stilling of the inner storm. His eyes gleamed at her maliciously in the candlelight. Jan was poised, ready to intervene. Then Isabel experienced one of those moments of heightened awareness that come occasionally to the minister. "What are you afraid of?" she heard him ask. "Afraid?" He laughed. Isabel saw that she had somehow struck home. "Yes, I suppose I am. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years," he quoted. "The Hound of Heaven," said Isabel, getting in quickly before he could tell her what it was. "What are you talking about?" "I struck a bargain that night," he said, "and I've spent the last year and a half trying to weasel out of it." There was another crack of thunder. They all jumped again. He gestured as if to say, "You see? The question is, the question I was, in my annoying way, working round to asking you, how does one know if one has a vocation?" A yelp of laughter leapt to Isabel's lips. She choked on it. "Well, if it's a genuine call, then eventually you'll find it's inescapable." "Shit," he said. "Well, your language will have to improve for a start," thought Isabel. "Do you really see yourself as a parish priest?" hooted Jan, voicing Isabel's rude scepticism for her. "Well, there's always college chaplaincy," he replied. "I could continue my studies, corrupt the youth in my care, and piss away my hospitality allowance unhindered." No ontological change there, then, said Jan. Precisely. So that's how it goes when it's written out in full. And now to our final ingredient, the setting. And generally speaking, in traditional narrative, the more vivid the setting, the more the reader will like it. The great thing about novels is that they are low-tech virtual reality. They offer a world that the reader can enter and lose themselves in for hours and days at a time. In order for the setting to be convincing, the writer has to know it inside out and back to front. This doesn't mean that the place actually has to exist, though. Think of Middle Earth or Hogwarts. It doesn't mean that the writer has actually has to have been there either. Otherwise, we wouldn't have historical fiction. But what the writer does have to do is live and move and have their being in that place in their imagination. Oh, a bug on here. Excuse me. And Angels and Men was set in Durham, and part of the reason for doing that was to give expression to my love affair with that city. And one of the nicest compliments I've ever had was from someone who was visiting the city for the first time and told me afterwards he greeted it with a cry of recognition. I remember this! And he accused me afterwards of giving him false memory syndrome. But finally, some bigger questions. What's it like to finish a book, to set your cake on a plate before the world and let others devour it? Of course, the initial reaction is one of relief and triumph that you've actually finished it. But there's always that sense of failure. Yet again, you've failed to pull off what you set out to do. Well, I'm always intending to write a profound work of Dostoevskian proportions, which will receive unanimous critical acclaim and sell by the truckload. But every time I end up writing something else. When my third novel was published and didn't do particularly well, I found myself paralysed and unable to write. Looking back, I think what I felt was that my brain simply wasn't big enough for the task. It was just big enough to see how vast and important the task was, but not big enough to actually do it. And this is a very miserable state to be in, and I was stuck there for about 18 months. It's possible that all I really needed to do was take time out and allow the reservoirs to refill. I think I'd just written myself out, really. There is a lot of waiting involved in writing. Sometimes I use the image of a heron fishing. I don't know if you've ever seen one. They seem to stand around all day on the riverbank or the seashore, apparently doing nothing. But they aren't idle. They're consumed by a totally focused waiting for that moment when the prey becomes visible. Then they pounce. And I think writing feels like that to me anyway. There's also a lot of courage involved. It's a bit like walking on water, I suspect. If you stop and look around and wonder how you're doing it, your courage will fail and you'll sink. There were two things which stand out in my memory as having helped me during that difficult patch. The first was in a sermon that I heard, and the preacher said, and I think this was actually just in passing, "Don't look at what you're trying to do, look to the God who calls you. Don't look at what you're trying to do, look to the God who calls you." And the second helpful thing took place in a cave in Lanzarote, and it was so brilliant that I put it in my fourth book, Waste Not, Want Not. Another writer's motto. And I'll read you the extract now. You'll need a bit of background. The heroine is called Kate, and she's had a friend stay the night, a childhood friend, and his name is Sebastian Penn. And in case there are any groupies out there, that's Will's younger brother from book two. And he is a famous screen idol. He's just kind of coming into land after making a very difficult and demanding film, also recovering from a disastrous relationship, and he's had an accountant who's been embezzling his money. And she's rather sick of his self-deprecation. The action starts the morning after the night before. "May I have a bath in your lovely, lovely tub?" he asked. "Pleasy, pleasy, lemon squeezy." "Sure. I may have to peep at you in the noddy, though," she warned. He did his deep sigh thing. Darling, the entire world has seen me in the noddy. OK, then off you go. She heard him turn the taps. The water began to hiss. How come men could hold their booze better? He should be wrecked too. On the other hand, you could say women use their alcohol more economically and effectively. They got plastered faster and quicker. Drink less better, that's my motto, she consoled herself. Do you have any bath oil or anything? He called over the noise of the water. No, I'm allergic. Gives me fungus in my girly bits. Oh, I so know what you mean. Oh, here's some dead sea salt. May I use that? Anything. Eventually, the taps were turned off and she heard him climbing in. Oh, God, bliss, he moaned. The hissing in the tank subsided. A bird scrabbled along overhead. Seb was still humming quietly. A tear squeezed its way out under her gritty eyelids. She dozed and then came to with the thought that she had Sebastian Penn in her bath and all she could do was snivel. You're going to look back on this as a wasted opportunity. She shoved her glasses back on, dragged herself to the loft edge. She's got a loft bed over the bath. She hung her head over the edge. Hello down there. Well, hello, he smarmed like an elderly roué. Care to come and join me? Ugh, don't want your germs, Penn Eddies. He cocked an eyebrow at her, hinting perhaps that she'd been less squeamish the night before. Tell you what, I'll come down and talk to you. She wrapped herself in the duvet, not having his insouciance. Only about half the world had seen her in the noddy. And she clambered down. There was a stool near the tub. She dragged it across and sat. Want your back scrubbing? Ooh, please. She sandpapered him briskly with the loofah. Ow, ow, God! There you go. That was an interesting little experience. He sank back, closed his eyes. Not remotely pleasurable, but thank you all the same. Any time. He still had his eyes shut. Seriously, you're an angel, he went on. You saved me from myself, darling. I had the sense I was on the brink of a 5-day bender, waking up next to God knows who, God knows where. You know the routine. Certainly do. So, thanks. My pleasure. She looked at him. That film really messed you up, didn't it? You know, I believe it did. Or else it uncovered new layers of hitherto unsuspected messed upness. Worth it, though, facing down the demons, all that stuff. He opened his green eyes suddenly and looked at her. Good to do that now and then, if you can only get the courage somehow. How did you get the courage then? She asked. In a Spanish cave. Will you wash my hair for me, please, 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 please? I love people fiddling with my hair. He thrust the shampoo at her. Well, with my anything, actually. What about your bank accounts? She said meanly. Don't. She took the shampoo. All right, then. Be gentle with me, he begged. Stop whinging. She began lathering him up. Tell me about this cave. Well, it was one of those last-ditch attempt at shoring up the relationship type of holidays last summer. He, and for the sake of this little narrative, we'll call him the tapeworm, wanted to go on this guided tour of some caves. In the last cavern, the guide said, we're going to test the depth of the famous deep drop by throwing a stone down it. We all peered in and gasped, totally bottomless. Hang on to your toddlers, that kind of stuff. Push in your unwanted partners, she suggested. The thought flittered, my dear. It distinctly flittered. That's good. Don't stop. She massaged his scalp dutifully and he groaned. Yes, she prompted, and? Oh, so she asked for a volunteer. And a little lad stepped forward. Listen for the stone hitting the bottom, the guide said. Count how many seconds. The boy threw the stone in, and immediately the whole thing fragmented and we all leapt back in shock. What? How do you mean? Well, it wasn't a huge hole at all, was it? It was a pool, reflecting the vast echoing cavern above us, all done by cunning lighting. The water was only a couple of inches deep. And my mind went, aha. He held his breath and slid under the water, rinsing the bubbles from his hair. He came up, streaming, and she handed him a towel. Go on. Aha, went your mind. Aha, it went. He buried his face briefly in the towel. Even something incredibly shallow is capable of reflecting great heights and depths. He began toweling his hair dry. You're doing it again, she sang. Why do you think you're incredibly shallow? Because I am. I am a small, vain, trivial man in the entertainment business, for God's sake, making films. One who, furthermore, is about to put on yesterday's underpants. He paused and dried his ears, then he smiled at her. Because I'm a human being, basically. And we're all shallow, right? She rolled her eyes in disgust. "Compared with the heights and depths, darling," he said in his Royal Shakespeare Company voice, "compared with the heights and depths." So there you go. That was my cave experience rendered into fiction. And that really was a turning point for me, a moment of pure illumination. It was tempting during my lowest points to think, well, okay then, I'll just write rubbish. At least that will sell. But despite everything, I still felt I had an obligation to write the best books that I could. Here's a quote from Teilhard de Chardin, which helped clarify this dilemma for me. "Lord Jesus, I am willing to be possessed by you, to be bound to your body, and led by its inexpressible power towards those solitary heights which by myself I should never dare to climb. Instinctively, like all mankind, I would rather set up my tent here below on some hilltop of my own choosing." This, I think, is the calling of every one of us, not just of artists and writers and musicians. I remember once hearing of someone who was on holiday in the foothills of the Himalayas. He was only there for a few days, but was desperately disappointed that it was too cloudy ever to see the mountains. Each day he woke up and rushed to the window and was greeted by the same bank of cloud blocking the view. On the last day, rather miserably, he sagged close to the window, craned his neck and looked up. And there, above the top of the clouds, soaring higher than he'd ever imagined, were the tops of the Himalayas. This gives me just an inkling of the vast impossibility of God, towering far beyond everything we can ever conceive of, and making all our religion and all our writing and talking about God just so much impertinence. And yet I believe the call still comes to us to leave our chosen hilltops and climb those solitary heights far higher than we would ever dare to go alone. Thank you. Questions. We've got a bit of time now, and roving mic coming round.
I wondered which of your heroines you were most like, and is Jolly Whittaker your ideal man?
Yes, I get asked that quite a lot. No, because I think he's a bit of a pig, isn't he? Tackling that last bit first. Which am I most like? I think there's bits of me in all of them. That tends to happen, I think, if you're writing with one strong central character who is of the same age and gender as you are. It's not saying these are all little mini versions of me, but my experiences and my observations do colour those characters. But I don't know. I couldn't choose. I hope I'm not like Maura Johns, because I think she's impossible.
I wondered how much your characters are based on real people that you know and what problems that causes, if they are.
I try not to put in people I know, though I did once have a kind of fictional revenge on a very lecherous chef I once had the misfortune of working with. And then when I came to look at the book afterwards, I'd actually given him the same name even. And I made him gay. But by the time, even if you do kind of pinch someone and put them in your book, which I think is probably a slightly disreputable thing to do, by the time the action's up and running, they tend to become a separate and different character in their own right. Well, it seems to happen with me. The only other time I did put in a good friend who was vice principal of a college in Durham, I put her in my second book, just for a joke, really. It's because what I hadn't anticipated after the first book was the extent to which everyone would think that there was a hidden code and all these people related to people I knew. And a lot of people spent ages trying to work it out. So I thought, oh, this would be really good. I'll put a real one in and that will kind of double the confusion. But by and large, I don't. Certain certain characteristics tend to be jumping off points. Or sometimes you see someone and they look striking and you've no idea what they're like because they're a complete stranger, but the way they look begins to generate a character in your head, and you may use them like that. But no, I think it's a bit below the belt to do that, unless they've really annoyed you.
I missed the first 10 minutes because I couldn't find the tent, so I'm sorry if this question, you've already covered this, but yeah. I'm interested to know whether, when you're starting on a new book, whether you spend a lot of time planning and whether you know what's going to happen before or whether it happens as you write.
You have to buy the tape. I did.
You did. I'm sorry.
I'll recap briefly. I used to think that I had a pretty clear plan. Although it's always, because my books are driven by the characters rather than a framework, and I think, well, now this character needs to do this. Because I find if I try and do that, then this character says, well, I'm not doing that, thank you very much. And because they seem to me so real. But with my fourth book, the one I've just finished, I really didn't know very clearly what was going to happen or even why I was writing it, what the point of it was, which was a bit scary. But, I mean, I hope that doesn't strike the reader. What is this book about? But, yes, I think as time's gone by, I've got more relaxed about planning them. Okay.
I just wondered how much redrafting you do, whether you redraft as you go along, or have you ever got to the end of a book and thought, I need to rewrite the whole thing?
Not rewrite the whole thing. I've encountered editors who think I should do that. I think probably in those periods of waiting and you know, heron-like on the bank, apparently doing nothing to the untrained eye, there's a lot of work going on in the subconscious. By the time it hits the page or the screen, it's more or less as I want it to be. Sometimes I get stuck and I think, why is this not writing itself? Why am I not able to progress? And it's usually that I've got a scene in the wrong place, so I would then have to juggle that round. But now I've just finished a book and I reckon I will need to revise it, but that will just be tightening up inconsistencies. Or, for instance, if I got two-thirds of the way through and I think, oh, hang on, in order for this to happen, something needs to go in here, and there are one or two bits like that I have to put in, but not very much. Some writers I know will just kind of churn out a first draft and then cut it and cut it and cut it until it's honed and what they want. That's just different ways of working. That's not my way.
Hello, am I right in thinking you're a vicar's wife?
I am, yes.
I'm not. When I was reading The Benefits of Passion, I derived great amusement wondering how your husband's parishioners reacted to it. And I really wanted to know, actually.
When I wrote that one, we were living in Gateshead.
I've lived in Gateshead too.
Oh,
yes.
Right. And the parishioners didn't read it, I think. They were waiting for the miniseries. They said, "Oh, we don't read books." A lot of them, some of them did. I think some people. Well, what tended to happen is word got round that they were a bit racy, which is probably true of the second one. And then I think it became a kind of matter of pride not to be shocked by it. So I think probably some of them were shocked, but they weren't going to admit it.
Yeah.
Because so and so had read it, and she thought it was all right. Well. I'm not going to be shocked by anything she's not shocked by.
That worked in your favour, I guess.
Sorry?
That worked in your favour.
I think so, yes. So there, it is true to say there are people who have been deeply offended and have destroyed the book. I think I want to say that. It should go on a strap line on the cover. This book has been destroyed by, burnt in the streets or something. I think what can happen is that people who don't read very much contemporary fiction in general might be tempted to pick up one of my books because I'm a vicar's wife, thinking, well, at least there's not going to be any of that kind of stuff in here. whereas, of course, it's wall-to-wall, that kind of stuff. So it's a mismatch of expectations. And, I think all I can say is, well, I'm sorry that you had the wrong impression about it. It's not trying to be Christian fiction, in inverted commas. It has to go out there in the secular marketplace and hold its own with all the other secular books.
You don't pretend there's somebody else with the same name for those purposes. that Catherine Fox.
You think that's my real name.
It's your maiden name, isn't it?
No, it's not my maiden
it's
name.
It's not,
no,
right.
No, it's a completely fabricated pseudonym. No, Catherine's my first name.
Yes,
well, that was a deliberate choice. So that there was some distance, really, between me as a mum and a wife and a vicar's wife, and me coming and doing this kind of thing.
To plan your characters, you can have anyone doing anything, and at some point they then have a life of their own where they can drive the novel.
Yes,
how do you actually get the initial boundaries, other than just your basic where they come from, but the boundaries of what they are like as a person, so that you can make them come alive?
I think I think about it a lot. And the other thing is, you put them in a setting, you make them interact with another character. That's when you get to see what they're like. It's difficult. Sometimes it's sort of extended daydreaming. You think you've got this character. What was it like when they were at university? Did they go to university? What was their childhood like? And you just play with the ideas, and then you think, no, I don't like that, scrub that. And eventually, I think you tend to have far more that you know about the character than ever appears in the text. It really is an iceberg thing. The reader gets to see the top 10% or whatever it is with icebergs. But they sense the presence of all that thought that you've done. And if that isn't there, then the character isn't going to stand up and walk and be as real as if you literally had only bothered to think about the bits that were going in the text. Okay.
A lot of new writers have great difficulty in finding a publisher and have lots of rejections. Was that your experience, and would you have any advice for people on that?
I'm sorry to say it wasn't my... Well, I'm not sorry to say. I mean, just from the point of view of anyone struggling out there. I was very fortunate that I got an agent very quickly. And it was sort of word of mouth, really. I knew someone else who was a writer. And I said, do you have an agent? She said, yes, I do. And I said, do you think I could send my book to her? And she said, yes, I'll write a letter to say my friend's sending you a book. And then she said, but all that will mean is that you'll rise to the top of the pile. If they don't like it, they'll still send you their polite get lost note, which they're all very good at doing. So any advice? Peg away at it. And I would. It has got harder, I think, in the last 10 years, 15 years. Probably true to say that it has, but that they are always agents and publishers always looking for the next new thing. They're always looking for an individual voice, and they know it when they see it. I mean, obviously they miss some big ones, like all the editors who missed J.K. Rowling and had to be taken out round the back and shot. But the main thing is keep trying, and your individual voice. Do what you do. Don't try and write to the market. Don't try and look and think, oh, everyone's writing chick lit, I must write one, then I'll get published. Write what you write, do what you do, and do what only you can do. That's the best advice, and don't lose heart. If it's good enough, it will find a home eventually. One more, I think. Was there someone at the back in black there, just been waving for 5 minutes?
I just wanted to know, your books seem to use subsidiary characters from your books that you've written before.
Yes.
I just wondered if you knew you were going to do that, because there's characters in your first book that are popping up in your third book.
Yes.
And we're getting explanations for things. do you know when you write the first book that you're going to answer these questions, or?
No, not always. No, sometimes I spot it coming. So in the third book, that would give away the plot, wouldn't it? But no, I won't say that. But sometimes you can, if you know what's going to happen in the next book. And I don't have any idea what I'm going to write my fifth novel will be, so I can't have put any little clues in the book four, well, unless I did it accidentally. But you can have something in there, so when the next book comes, people will say, aha, I remember that funny bit in the previous book where she was so upset, now I know why. But I didn't conceive of writing a series of three books. The first three really work together. The next one is a bit of a departure from that, although some of the same characters or connected characters appear in it. Now I've completely lost track of what I was saying. But I don't have a very clear plan of it. But I, if you spent that much time writing about a particular character, they almost become real people. And it's a real wrench at the end of a book to let them go. So if in the next book you think, oh, here comes so-and-so again. And it's nice because they're like old friends, and I think if the readers have enjoyed the first book, they do want to know what happened to them subsequently. Okay, thanks. I think there's just one more announcement.
This is more of a plug. If you've liked what you've heard this afternoon, you can actually get one of the first hearings of Catherine's fourth novel tonight. In between the lines, Subway, Writers' Cafe. For those of you who have no idea what that is, it's actually an open mic. The idea is that anybody can come along, whether you're a published writer like Catherine or somebody who put together a limerick a couple of days ago that you'd like to get out there and have a bit of feedback on. We'd like to have a lot of voices. Obviously, the main voice this evening will be Catherine, and I'm sure a lot of people will be coming to hear hers. But could I encourage you that this is Greenbelt. This is not just the festival where you sit back and you be inspired by the person at the front and then do nothing. This is the place where you can come and actually take some risks and actually try and do some of the things that Catherine's been talking about. Actually take that recipe, trying to make it work in your own voice. So if you're up for that, 6 to 8, Between the Lines, that's in Jesus Christ Superstore. We'd be really grateful to hear from you and see you tonight. Thanks.
I will be over in the SPCK, in the Jesus Christ Superstore tent, signing books shortly, if anyone wants to buy one, which is why I'm here.
All right, I think she did very well, despite the background noise. Can you please give her a big round of applause?